Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sorrow Gone Rogue, yet another installment on politics in every sphere and possible place one can imagine. We're going to look at a number of issues this week. We're going to look at essentially the polls that reveal the disintegration of the ANC and related issues. I will talk briefly about the state and requiring some sympathy, the police find themselves in with regard to the lack of provision of resources for them to do their job. And interestingly, going back to the news and discussion on Howard's program about people being scammed into being trafficked into jobs that don't really exist, or to be exploited, or to literally have their money taken from them, and that unemployment is a contributing factor. Well, my interview with Herman Pretorius this morning deals with that on a much more fundamental and almost philosophical level, and the extent to which it affects society here in terms of bad policy and the resultant terrible consequences of those policies. So we will come to that shortly. I'm sorely amused by the fact that Bambi Thug has cancelled herself and her earning potential. Hopefully there was much earning potential, because I gather the song is pretty grim. But all I can say is roll on Mental Health Awareness Month. I think we are underestimating the extent to which the hysteria and the ill-informedness and the failure to see nuance and the woke instincts is more than just... It's not a fad. It's turning the possibility that there are mental health issues that are being essentially regarded as virtues. Anyway, that's my little rant for this morning. Just to look at the situation the police are in, it's actually quite dire. And if you think how high up the list of criminal activities South Africa falls, you know, it being really one of the world's top criminal sites for criminals, both organized and not organized, the task for an otherwise politically emasculated police force that doesn't serve the public adequately for policy and political and corruption reasons. We have a situation where there was an article in the Sunday Times this week indicating that they are so sorely stretched. There are few cars that are working. They're not getting tires replaced. Head officers are not responding to requests where money needs to be spent. Over 80% of income, of budget, to the police goes to salaries. Now, I presume that's, you know, a majority proportion of any budget to any police force anywhere would largely be to salaries, because it's the manpower that is fundamental to providing the service. But the people do not have a bulletproof vest. And you can be fairly sure that you go into certain crime scenes, either that have happened or are happening or threatened to happen, that guns are going to be used. And people are saying if they've used a gun and it's gone in for assessment in order for a report to be produced regarding the incident, there's no backup. There are no backup guns or ammunition for a policeman to carry on working until such report has been produced. As I say, complete shortage of bulletproof vests. In some cases, there are only, I think, you know, you'll have rural police stations that cover hundreds of kilometers, and there just are not enough cars to do it. So in this respect, I think we really, really do have to be concerned for the thin blue line and whatever attempts they make to try and protect our society.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Last week produced a number of reports and polls that give an indication of the extent to which the ANC is losing ground. I thought that the election last year, where it dropped to 40%, was the indication of the tipping point. And the information I'm going to discuss next suggests that tipping point has become a inevitable real slide down to the bottom. The first was the Mapungubwe Institute for Strategic Reflection, MISTRA, and it reported that the ANC has lost its majority in Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, the Northern Cape, and the Western Cape. Now the Western Cape, we know it doesn't govern, but it does still govern in coalition in Gauteng, KZN, and the Northern Cape, and not necessarily as the biggest party. They predict that the ANC will lose its majority in the Free State and in Mpumalanga in the 2029 national election. And apparently the Northwest Province, which is one of the disaster provinces as far as governance and management is concerned, is teetering on the brink of the ANC actually losing its majority. The outcome essentially of the report is that the ANC is likely to only retain a majority in Limpopo and the Eastern Cape. And one can only speculate that whatever may happen between now and 2029, maybe even those areas of profound support for the ANC may change, who knows. At the same time, the DA has been doing some polling. It's committed itself to tracking polling of registered voters in the metros every 2 weeks until the local government elections at the end of 2026, early 2027. Now, the DA has always done regular polling, and it's often reliable, even to its detriment, because it reveals maybe a loss of support in some area and a gain by another, as has happened with the Patriotic Alliance in parts of the Cape. The ANC used to do regular polling. I'm not sure if it kind of bothers anymore. I just haven't read any formal reports of polling being done. Anyway, the Democratic Alliance poll released last week suggests that in Johannesburg, the ANC is on 23% of support. The DA is on 40% as of August. And as I said, they're tracking registered voters. They're not going into people who are unlikely to have any influence on the election at all. In Shwani, the DA's support is at 48% and the ANC's at 27%. And Ekurhuleni has the DA at 41% and the ANC at 19%. So obviously, these numbers will change every 2 weeks as things do or do not happen. But they do reveal two things. One is the complete lack of faith in the future of the ANC by increasing numbers of voters. And the other is they still indicate that the GNU has been popular from day one, because people have seen that going into the GNU with the majority partner being the DA as being the most likely course to change things for the better here. So it's really a matter for the DA to grab the issue and reel in voters, particularly obviously the voters who were ANC voters, who are ANC voters, but they're floating. They're desperately unhappy and they're just not sure where to go and whether to commit. It will probably take, and I don't know enough about DA election policy and planning, but it probably will require, at some risk, I guess, to the individuals concerned, but really getting into communities to punt for the local elections and being seen to actually serve those communities in whatever capacity they can, whether or given, despite the fact that the DA does not have the majority in any of the big metros. But it is there for the DA to grab, and there's the added boost, which we've discussed before, of Helen Ziller throwing in her lot to stand as a candidate for mayorship in Joburg. And that seems to have got support from the most unlikely sources. But what's interesting is, and this was an article that came out of Business Day, is that ANC sources, in essentially insiders, not formal polls, believe that the ANC could get as little as 12%. Now, I think Frans Cronje, his prognostication was 20%, but as little as 12% in Johannesburg. And the blame to some extent is that the provincial leadership and the local leadership, which was advised to enter into coalitions with the DA, were thwarted. They went into coalitions with the EFF, Action SA, and others, and that their unpopularity has to do with that refusal to follow the national party line. So that's it displays a sense of anger, frustration, and pure common sense on the part of registered voters. Other issues that make the ANC decline inevitable, as far as people are concerned, is the continued reluctance to hold corrupt leaders and members accountable. And literally every day, another act of tenderpreneurship gone wrong, stolen, corruption, etc., is coming to the fore. The inability to address their concerns, the fact that people are losing benefits they once gained through the ANC, electricity, water, service provision, etc., is all collapsing because the ANC simply cannot manage the situation. And the doubling down on anti-growth policies, which suggests that perhaps the standoff with America is not supported at the level of the voters. And you're starting to get what I call disaffected ANC worthies criticizing essentially Cyril Ramaphosa's governance. Now, bearing in mind that the comments are coming from people who are under a cloud, such as Senzo Mkunu, the NEC member and suspended policeman minister, as a result of the Mkhwanazi allegations about interference in policing and the achievement of justice within the system. He said at a funeral that the ANC was facing imminent collapse and that the next local government elections will be make or break events. Now, the others who've come out in this respect are people like Naledi Pandor, who says, you know, there's been no leadership, decision making's been weak, etc. Tell us something we don't know. Malusi Gigaba, who I think is a thoroughly discredited, the fact that he even has in the position to make a comment against the leadership of the ANC is an indictment on the ANC, and saying that he's acted outside his mandate is probably irrelevant. And Andile Lungisa in the Eastern Cape, who's done the same sort of thing and nearly killed a DA member in a fight some years ago using a very heavy water jug. So, you know, the good and the bad are coming out against Ramaphosa, essentially.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Good morning to everybody. And this morning I want to deal with something that I have to confess I had not occurred to me, and it was the coming upon Herman Pretorius's article actually made it quite something. It's the idea that unemployment is not just a matter of socioeconomic vulnerability. It's that we know about. It's there's a symptom of it that is illustrative of how horrific the structural injustice exists in people being jobless and looking forward really to a life of joblessness. Herman, head of strategic communication at IRR, welcome to Chai FM again.
Thank you, Sarah. I would say it's a pleasure, but this time pleasure is perhaps not the right word. It is, however, a privilege, because in writing this article for the Daily Friend, it really came out of one little observation. Well, not little observation. In I think 2020, a crime psychologist who worked for SAPS, Dr. Gerard Labeschagne, published the first of two of his sort of case memoirs on cases he had worked on, and his field, being psychological in nature, really made him work with serial murderers and serial rapists. And it was his job to quite often understand when a series of rapes or murders were connected by a single killer or a single rapist. And he made this observation in his book that just turned my blood to ice, where he made the point that in a 2012 serial rape study, 70% of victims were lured to the scene of their attack by a con story, a lie to get this victim to go with or meet with the perpetrator. And then he goes on to say in almost half of those cases, 48%, the con story was a promise of a job. And when I read that, and I'm getting gooseflesh now and just saying it is the intense tragedy of it, is that women who are desperate for a job are exploited, murdered, raped, dehumanized, with predators understanding that the best way to ensure your victim shows up to where you need them to be is to promise them something as simple as a job. That is the extent of joblessness in this country, being bringing vulnerability to a whole new level. Something that I also hadn't considered before is that joblessness and the aspiration, the hope of getting a job, has become a weapon in the hand of some of the vilest scum in our society, with women, particularly poor Black women, being the primary victims of this injustice.
I mean, one would think that perhaps inherently the promise of something you really don't have would raise certain alarm bells and perhaps say, you know, this idea, you know, I've struggled to get a job. I'm trying to support X number of people or whatever the problem is. The chance of getting a job, a decent job, just incredibly remote. Is this not too good to be true? What causes that shift to actually be prepared to take the risk?
It is that your entire risk assessment from a psychological perspective changes. You and I in this call have the standing of socioeconomic status to allow us to not be tempted to accept as true something that to what one might consider an ordinary person looks dodgy. But that underestimates the level to which having nothing and no prospect changes your desperation to quite often look after yourself and loved ones. And we're not talking about these are jobs that were designed to, the lies of the jobs that were designed to make them sound incredibly lucrative, like, oh, it's too good to be true, so it probably isn't. In the one case, in the Muldersdrift serial rapist case, where the rapist was Shavani Poppy, the con lie of a job was a job of domestic work for an income of 2,800 rand a month. Good. That was how he lured his rape victims, not with anything extraordinary, but a figure of such, you know, a small figure that 2,800 rand was enough for these women. The hope of that was enough for these women to go, I cannot go on living as I'm living. This 2,800 rand a month will change my life. It'll put me in a better place. It might enable me to afford, I don't know, shoes for my kids, or just some better clothes for myself, or lighting in a home that doesn't have it. And that was enough then for these women to believe this man and go into this vulnerable position where they were, you know, either raped or murdered. And it's their risk assessment that changed. It is sort of the stories we hear in post-war Europe. In terms of water sources, quite often you would hear people drunk from water sources that they shouldn't have drunk from, but they were just so thirsty. Try telling a thirsty individual that the water they can see has a bacterial level that might kill them. The thinking in minds is that, well, if the bacteria isn't going to kill me, I'm going to die in any case. It's that level of desperation, but just of a socioeconomic structural perspective, that make these women confuse aspiration and expectation to this fatal extent. And we cannot be snide about this. We cannot look down on them until we have been in a position of being so destitute that this promise is enough for you to put your life on the line. And the shocking observation, I think, too, that struck with me is that Labuschagne writes about how this is a tactic that works because of the socioeconomic context. It isn't, oh, they've tried a few tactics here and there and this one seems to have stuck. No, no. The circumstances making this lie so potent is based on the hope that is being dashed day after day. And it just struck me, and that's why I wrote the piece, is that our predators understand policy consequences better than our politicians.
And of course it would, you know, you've got the added complication, and South Africa has this writ large. Your largest population group that is unemployed is black women. You've got fatherless households, so you're relying on one income for a group of people, amongst a group of people who are the least likely to get employment. And very often there'll be elderly people that they take responsibility for as well. So the level of desperation has to literally just keep multiplying and multiplying. And you don't have the support network of a man's view of something when another man offers the opportunity for employment. So it's this whole compounding socioeconomic wasteland almost that leads to this extraordinary, what hadn't even occurred to us, but extraordinarily amoral element to not tackling the unemployment crisis.
And I thought that I try to end the piece on a note of sort of ominous warning, where I try to make the point is that we've got predators who use the promise of a better life to abuse. At the same time, we've got politicians who use the promise of a better life to abuse. I'm not saying there's a perfect moral equivalence, but I'm saying that there's a sick psychological and moral category that you fall into once you start using the desperation of people to further your own ends. And we see fake transformation advocates do that. We see the doubling down of BEE. Why? Because it promises a job that will allow the person making the promise to gain advantage, either through the continued structural deprivation that balances spending towards the elites, therefore you line your own pocket, or you could get a vote. But the fact is that you are using the promise of a job to lure someone, a vulnerable, desperate someone, to a place where they could satisfy your needs. And there's something quite sick about the link between serial rape or serial murders and perhaps political serial liars who have a similar modus operandi. And it bears repeating that this isn't an isolated con story. It is a fixture of how South African serial predators work. And I think our late great colleague Ian Cruikshank made this point that hungry people become angry people. And if we look at the murderers who commit and the rapists who commit these crimes, quite often there's an excuse of anger. But then you also get back to the fact that, I'm not saying deprivation caused the psychological evil, but we live in a society where deprivation is so commonplace that the psychopathic tendencies can't be spotted because people have been reduced in many ways to animalistic survival instincts, that if you've got people who are so desperate and people are so vicious that they sort of find each other on the fringes of society where they can sort each other out through rape and murder, it becomes just toxic how the socioeconomic injustice makes it not only impossible to put up burglar bars or install a front door that can lock or travel at better times, not in the dead of night, or travel through better areas with more streetlights, or in fact possibly afford your own vehicle that allows you to commute to a place of work that is in and of itself safe. The layers of safety that social deprivation peels away until there is literally just the risk aversion of a desperate person between them and a murder and them and a rape. It's the point that these socioeconomic deprivation pressures can even tear away that last line of defense, which is your own survival instinct. And that's what these predators do. They use their victims' own survival instinct to be able to eat the next day, to clothe their kids the next day, to lure them to their fate. And as a joblessness outpouring, I think that is an underappreciated evil.
I wonder if I'm making a link that's perhaps two way off, but it always struck me as really amoral that the ANC government, and Cyril Ramaphosa in particular, seem to take a real pride in the fact that more people are on social grant than are in employment. And to me, it's sort of the flip side of the same sort of exploitation. The lure of a little bit to make life tolerable, which, you know, one can't deny that would be the case, whereas a better economy offers the promise of something more than just a tolerable survival existence, but actually the chance for you and the family that you're trying to bring up to develop and become something more prosperous.
Indeed, and I once spoke to a psychologist, a forensic psychologist, a clinical psychologist, who made the point that if she were to diagnose the South African people, and she had sort of started entertaining the notion, and I regret never going further, but perhaps I'll pick it up again, but if she were to diagnose the South African population as an individual, as a patient, the patient would probably show all the signs of battered spouse syndrome, where it is you stay in the abusive relationship you currently have because you've been convinced that you on your own are unworthy and that there's no one else aim to be interested in you. And in that battered citizen syndrome, we could call it, is this dependency culture of and we see this every time with the ANC, particularly last year. I remember I was attuned to this because it was fascinating for me to see it play out psychologically. How many times did we hear the ANC saying, if we lose power, grants are gone. Education grants, SASA, education grants, housing, all of it gone. And that's the same tactic as the abuser saying, you're happy with me, but you're never going to get someone better than me. You're not worth it. You don't have the agency. You're too ugly. You're too fat. You're too old. You're too damaged. I've abused you too much. No one will be interested in you. And there's a predatory nature in that boast of saying, we've made more people than ever before dependent on us. We've stripped them of the agency, we've stripped them of aspiration, but good old us, we've got more people on a leash than last year.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And one of the things that is obviously linked to this is the fact that we don't have a growing economy, and you had the extraordinary sight of Cyril Ramaphosa asking the beneficiaries of BEE to come forward and say how they benefited from BEE. And not only are there comparatively very few of them, but who the hell is going to come forward and say they benefited from BEE? Because it will either go to a level of corruption and card rate deployment, or it will attest to the fact that some where merit was not the prime consideration. And so either way, they'd have to admit to not having a genuine entitlement.
Yes, not adding value. And essentially just exploiting. And I want us to almost contrast that, what he said there, with what he said on the campaign trail, when a young woman, I can't remember where it was, it might have been in Soweto, where a young woman came to the president whilst he was campaigning on the ground, and she said, Mr. President, we've got real fears about my mother's RDP house, whether she is owning it securely, and whether she'll be able to pass it on to us if she dies. And the incredible response from our dear president, when this woman asked him what she should do, the billionaire man said, I think you should get a lawyer. how out of touch, how removed from the pressures of ordinary existence that you could ask a woman in a township asking you, or you can tell a woman in a township asking you about an RDP house, that how about she dusts off those extra few thousand rand she might have to go see a lawyer. Now compare, this is the man who also said to be e-beneficiaries, you know, let's face up. This is also the man who at the National Dialogue said, how is it possible that we've got rich people and such poor people? It is, there's a lack of reflection and honesty and possibly emotional intelligence that is astonishing and that puts them on the par of you know, just being these apparatchiks blind by what an economist recently I read called the pathology of privilege. And I think that's so perfect because what President Ramaphosa and the BEE elites are doing is pathological. And it is such a clinging to their privilege. And contrast that with the promise of a 2,800 rand per month job. And you've just got this idea of, yep, they are, Maggie was right, there are two South Africans. He was just so wrong about which two.
Can I just float something sort of tangential about this and why the dissatisfaction is so profound that the ANC may nationally end up with 20% or less of the popular vote in the next few elections? And that is that they were always, as voters were prepared to give the ANC a chance because they had done quite a lot for the people in the first 10 years and but now they've got a generation of children who are adults who were not part of the, who were not brought up under apartheid. So they're removed from the sort of emotional historical draw, and they're seeing that their children are possibly going to be worse off even than they are.
Yes.
And part of it, I wonder whether that isn't the ultimate practical thing that has made people say we're not prepared to be, you know, to be made to feel like nothing anymore. We want more, we deserve more. Our children, we promise them more.
Yes, and a political party's identity or its brand or its reputation is sort of that question of living memory. What has this party done in living memory that would align it with my values? And this sort of living memory component is actually quite prevalent in a lot of nations. You see it with the American South, where you actually had after Lincoln, two or three generations, i.e., living memory, because living memory is usually two or three generations of Black voters voting Republican because Lincoln was Republican and Lincoln emancipated the slaves and Lincoln won the Civil War and Lincoln passed the anti-slavery constitutional amendment. And the problem with the ANC is what I think we often miss about the ANC is that its 1994, 1999, 2004 election results, we should see them in the context of living memory. And I'm reading a fascinating book called A Kind of Magic, which is an analysis of the ANC's political marketing, in which Ranchot, the author, makes this, says that in the 50s and 60s and 70s, the ANC was a civil activism organization, not just a political party. They were also, in many cases, taking over competencies of the police. That if you had a problem of, you know, someone broke in, they were sort of like an Afriforum to sort of insult both camps, in the sense that they had policing forums in communities and they were there for you if you had problems. And there are instances where apartheid officials actually referred Black people to say, we can't solve your problem, go to the comrades, i.e. go to the ANC in your local branch, sort of like the Afriforum in your local branch of this pothole or that broken streetlight or that shebeen. And so the ANC had a rich living memory bank that it could cash in those early elections, 1994, 1999, 2004. It added in those 10 years a rollout of service delivery, growing job numbers, and the 2004 election will go down in history as the ANC's best election ever, earned on the back of not just 10 years of governance, giving them an astonishing majority, greater majority after 10 years in power. That just doesn't happen in global politics anyway. But it also comes off the back of living memory, having them prove themselves at a ground level. And that's why we're going to see, probably if the ANC collapses now, not stably, but sort of off a cliff, it's because of the living memory problem. Is what they've done in living memory will cease to be the activist ANC, the Mbeki ANC, the Mandela ANC. It'll just be the elite ANC, the criminologically interesting ANC, the kleptocrats, the Gupta ANC, and the do-nothing Ramaphosa ANC. That's their problem with the question of living memory, and why this new generation isn't just the start of a new generation to start to be won over by the ANC, but a generation on which their historic charms have no purchase whatsoever.
Absolutely. Herman Pretorius, thank you for that. Getting sort of two interviews in one, could have. But thank you very much, and I'm sure we'll have you back sooner rather than later.
A great pleasure as ever, Sarah. Thank you.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
What's recently come to attention, and I decided to talk about this a little, is that we have a Minister of Tourism, Patricia de Lille, who has essentially dissolved South Africa, the Board of South African Tourism. And what's interesting about this is that it appears that it was a board that was actually tackling real problems within South African tourism. It had placed the CEO on precautionary suspension a couple of weeks ago. And the concerns were that she'd bypassed fair labor processes and attempted to remove executives without proper board consultation. She also, there was a 4.1 million rand irregular prepayment flagged by the Auditor General and an independent forensic audit. So generally one gets a sense that the board was actually doing what it needs to do with the office bearers that are not to the advantage of either the running of the organization or in advancing South African tourism in general. And this had been preceded by a vote of no confidence in the chairman. And, you know, they accused the chairman of basically not resolving a whole lot of issues as meant to resolve, and not facilitate a performance evaluation of the CEO. Now, you know, those sort of actions are the sort of things one's come to expect from government entities. And, you know, the minister responsible might dissolve a board that is involved in those activities themselves. But to have dissolved the board for apparently technical reasons, which was actually trying to do the job and get things done, is really quite extraordinary. I mean, tourism is supposed to be one of our growth industries, and it's not just a growth industry in the sense of bringing money into the fiscus, but it's a service industry. And because it's a service industry, it is the one of the few industries that we have that really could offer growth in jobs, because people are needed to service other people. And it's got to be, you know, an absolutely crucial area. And there's so much of our hierarchy, so much of our regulation affecting tourism and the management of tourism has become very bad to poor. There are pockets of excellence, but there are boards, there are wildlife park management structures that barely work or work very badly. And it's really one of the potentially wasted opportunities of South Africa growing its economy, and it needs every resource it can use. I mean, our manufacturing, we have literally sort of deindustrialized South Africa, and we're making things very difficult for any form of investment in most areas, including mining. So tourism should be absolutely the most profoundly professionally run entity. And it looks like the Minister, Patricia de Lille, is interrupting and interfering with that.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
I thought I would give you some good news as well as just noting a response from audience members, from Mike Lubo, about how Cyril got his money for free from CODESA. Well, actually, there were no sunset clauses on obtaining RDP houses. The big guys got their share at 50% of the market value for free. They were sold immediately, and then 8 years later, there was a cry of no black holdings. Well, you know, it's if you're going to give people houses, they've got to have ownership in the true and proper sense. But the good news that I want to end with is actually comes from government and is quite significant in that Transnet's decades-long rail monopoly has essentially come to an end. The Transport Minister, Barbara Creasy, last week announced that 11 private sector operators chosen from 25 applicants have been conditionally awarded slots to run trains on Transnet's rail network. And the trains are designed to carry mostly things like coal, manganese, other mining products, mining resources. And the allocations are destined to run from between 1 and 10 years. I'm not quite sure what would be attractive about a one-year allocation. But the reporting from the industry and from people involved in and knowledgeable about train networks is that they seem to have very high regard for her, and that she really is trying to do something. And part of her battle is to deal with the existing management of Transnet. And this should ease. It gets the trains operating. It gets the goods to the ports more efficiently. It doesn't involve using numerous trucks to transport goods which destroy roads. It's getting us back to a situation we saw disintegrate completely during the COVID period and never paid attention to. And was known as huge sort of corruption and cadre deployment and tenderpreneurship. So there seems to be some real support for this. I guess whether it will be successful or not will depend on the specific terms of the deals and whether the government continues to support the initiative, because the infrastructure is supposed to remain in government possession, in government ownership. But this is particularly crucial when you think how much we've lost to our neighbours in Mozambique and Namibia in the last couple of years, who've taken over more and more port and freight functions because we're essentially doing nothing to invest properly in our trade infrastructure. So that private sector involvement is the first time that this is a real recognition that that things are not going to be restored and revitalized and reinvested in unless the private sector is given the right space and the right inducements to do so. And maybe this will be the one. The jury's out, but it certainly looks hopeful. And that on that hopeful note and the suggestion that home ownership and deeds entitlement is an absolute must. Property ownership is core to the success of a democracy. Thank you for being with me. I will be here again this time next week looking at the extraordinary, the worrying, and the sometimes just bizarre. Thank you. Signing off, Sarah Gone Rogue.